Yeah, we're going. Okay.
I'm not paying.
That's great. I wasn't sure if you. I hadn't been in touch with him for a while, so.
Yeah, I know. He's
been
pretty busy.
Yeah. He's coming. Cool. All right. Well, welcome back to week two. And just to recap, does anybody remember what we talked about last week?
Everything from last year.
Almost everything from last year, but not quite. We talked about really how Zionism was a convergence of the ancient and the modern, right? There was this powerful stream of thought and consciousness about Zion or Zion going throughout Jewish history. We saw the texts from the biblical times. We didn't talk about it, but continuing through the Middle Ages, and most of the prayers, by the way, that we do today were written in the Middle Ages, but many of them have Zion or Zion as a concept in them as well. Then we talked about the modern confluences of ideology, whether it was socialism or communism or anarchism or, Zionism was certainly one. The only thing that Jews didn't do was favor monarchism for obvious reasons, although there were some Jews who were the intermediaries, the Shtadlanim, as they were called in Yiddish and Hebrew. Then we really talked about Herzl and the beginning of the movement and the settlement waves and really just kind of building everything up in what was called the Yishuv or pre-state Israel, then known as Palestine under the British, the Palestinian the British Mandate. Were there any questions or would anybody like any more information on what we covered last week? I'll take that as a no, unless I hear otherwise. There are two things we didn't get to last week, which I want to cover before we go into this week's material. One was the rise of Tel Aviv, which some of you know I believe is the most fascinating story of modern Zionism, besides just the overall survival, of course, of the state. And then David Ben-Gurion. We talked about Jabotinsky and revisionist Zionism, but we didn't talk about Ben-Gurion. And Ben-Gurion is, of course, someone once said he's Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln rolled into one. Here is my favorite picture in Zionist history. These are people getting together outside Tel Aviv to pick which lot their home is going to be on. Not outside Tel Aviv, I'm sorry. This would now be the heart of Tel Aviv. This is 1909. And it's a little hard to see because it's been blown up so much, but let me give you a couple facts. In 1906, something called the Achuzot Bayit Society was found. That really means the grasping of a home, or the retaining or the capturing of a home, and it was formed to create a Jewish city because there were no Jewish cities. Jaffa or Yafo was primarily Arab. Jaffa is now incorporated into Tel Aviv. The formal name of the city is Tel Aviv Jaffa or Tel Aviv Yafo. Haifa was a mixed city. Tiberias was a mixed city. Jerusalem was a mixed city. Hebron was a mixed city. So these folks said, if we're really going to build a Jewish society here and now, we need to have Jewish cities. Well, there was a guy named Theodor Herzl, who we already know about. In his book, Alte Neuland, Old New Land, he talked about Tel Aviv, the first Jewish city. So they took that name from there. Their goal was to form a Hebrew urban center in a healthy environment planned according to the rules of modern hygiene. Now, that sounds kind of weird. However, there was no running waters in many of the communities in Palestine at that time. There were certainly no hospitals. There were certainly very few, if any, roadways that you could get your wagon through without it getting stuck in mud. If you walked through an Arab village at that time, you would see people with eyes encrusted from various diseases, malaria,
There was a lot of malaria.
A lot of malaria, high infant mortality rate. You know, these are all the things, by the way, that people like Henrietta Tsol said, we want to help with. Come back Tel Aviv, easy come, easy go. I love this. So in April 1909, representatives of 66 families gathered on these desolate sand dunes to parcel them out. This was organized by a guy named Akiva Arya Weiss. He was president of the Building Society, and he had a kid collect 120 seashells. Half of them were white, half of them were gray. That depended on which side of the imaginary city that you were going to be on. Well, the members' names were written on the white shells, and they had the plot numbers on the gray shells, and they matched them up, and they said, this is how we're going to have a city. So by 1 year later, they had some streets done, a water system was installed, and 66 houses were built. 1 year. This is 1909, 1910. This is not like off Smith Avenue where they took the old Bonnie View Country Club and they put up 100 and so houses just like that. I was a busboy there back in old days. By 1914, they had 247 acres developed. By 1923, 16,000 people lived there. And listen to this growth. By 1926, 40,000 people lived there. And Tel Aviv today, as many of you know, is a remarkable city. So I'm going to do that contrast one more time, because I just think it's stunning. Well, you take a look at that, and you take a look at that. About 500,000 people in Tel Aviv itself. There's more than 1.5 million people in Metro Tel Aviv. 51,000 K-9 students. There weren't 51,000 Jews in the land of Israel at that time. 544 synagogues. Right? A lot of people think Tel Aviv is a very secular city. It has a chief rabbi, it has a lot of synagogues, and so on and so on. It has a lot of alternative synagogues, too. Alternative, by the way, means everything that's not controlled by the ultra-Orthodox rabbinate in Israel. 4.4% unemployment, 16 million visitors annually to Ha'ir Cohen Park. Anyone ever been to that park? It's a great park. A lot of fun. They have a lot of festivals there, and, you know, really right in the middle of the city. Absolutely beautiful. This is remarkable when you compare it to sand dunes. And you think about the growth of the city. I mean, Paris arose, I think, in the 11th or 12th century. It's taken a long time to get to what it is. 100 years? Really, really stunning. I think this is one of the undertold remarkable stories of the modern times, certainly the Jewish people. There's a Jewish city now. People speak in Hebrew. Doesn't close down on Saturday, but there's a different rhythm on Saturday. It's all pretty remarkable. And you know, some people, by the way, they say Tel Aviv is the capital of Israel and Jerusalem is the capital of Judea. I love that. Biblical Israel. So we all know who that guy is because we all recognize his hair, his beautiful hair. David Ben-Gurion, David Groen was his name in Poland, a remarkable figure. Here's a little bit of the bio. I'm going to read some stuff for you. This is a picture of him, by the way, from when he was in the Jewish Legion in 1918. He was expelled by the Turks in 1915 and made his way to Egypt, where he joined with Jabotinsky, who he was friends with at that time, to enter the Jewish Legion. And he actually entered Palestine with the Jewish Legion in World War II, which was a fighting force on behalf of the British Army. There would be another similar effort during World War II, although it wouldn't really see combat. Some of these folks in the Jewish Legion actually saw combat against the Turks in the Dardanelles, in the Gallipoli campaign, which was somewhat disastrous for the British. And even though the Turks won, it was somewhat disastrous for them as well. I mentioned he's Israel's founding father in many regards. He was from Płońsk, Poland. His house is still there. You can see pictures of it on the internet. There's all this talk about trying to make it into a museum. You know, the Polish people are very smart, right? They create all these Jewish sites of interest because tourism, right? And there's a lot of controversy over that. He's interesting in that, unlike most Zionist leaders, heroes, early figures, he didn't feel anti-Semitism growing up. His city was about roughly half Jewish and half non-Jewish, and he writes in his memoirs that basically if one of the Jewish kids got beaten up, they would just go and beat up the non-Jewish kid, and vice versa. So basically they were just being kids, right? They were gangs of kids roaming around. But he was a hardcore nationalist. He got this from his father. Theodor Herzl actually came to his town once, and he heard Herzl, and he writes in his diary, "Today I met the Messiah." And that's the way they saw Herzl. He was this dashing figure with, as it's been described, an Assyrian beard, and he was a very, very charismatic individual. Early on, he formed, at age 14, he formed a Hebrew-speaking club called Ezra with his friends. So here are these kids in Poland forming this Hebrew-speaking club. In 1916, he moves to Palestine. Again, he's about 19 years old at that point, and nothing says to him, as it did with Jabotinsky and others, the pogroms in 1903 in Kishinev were pushing me there. He was just a nationalist. He was singular in his vision. He was clearly very, very bright. Has anyone ever been to his house in Tel Aviv? Okay, if you go to his house in Tel Aviv, and I recommend you do it, you can go into his library, and there'll be shelves like this all the way around, the old wood shelves with the ladder, and this one's in ancient Greek, and this one's in ancient Latin, and this one's in French, and he read them all. He actually read them all. And there's, he talks about in one of his books where he was speaking with an Arab leader, which he did periodically in France or elsewhere, and they were speaking in French, and he said to the Arab leader, you'll have to excuse me, my spoken French is not really well. I've only read it before. That's the type of individual that he was. Very sharp, but singularly focused. Also could be a little bit petty and a little bit tyrannical as a leader. There are incidents later on where in the late 40s, he tries to push an agenda on the military and generals resign. He was legendary for hating certain politicians. You might remember we talked about Jabotinsky last week. Ben-Gurion basically said, over my dead body, will you bring Jabotinsky's great,
remains,
thank you, to Israel.
And they did.
They did it in 65. Levi Eshkol did it. Ben-Gurion lived until 73. But he was out of, even though Ben-Gurion stayed in power until, in the Knesset until 1970. He's got a remarkable leadership, by the way. 1906, he comes to Palestine. About a month later, he addresses a group of workers in Hebrew. By 1920, he's elected head of the Histadrut. By 1935, he's head of the Jewish Agency for Israel, bumping out Chaim Weizmann. There was no love lost between them either. I mean, these were clashes of the titans in many regards. In 1948, obviously, becomes Prime Minister of Israel. Stays in that role with the exception of 53 to 55 because of a political scandal, Prime Minister, until 1963. Hey, Rabbi, how you doing? 1970, he stays in the Knesset until 1970. Basically, if you were Ben-Gurion, enough people were going to vote for you no matter what. He breaks away from the Labor Party, which he creates at the end in 64, with young Turks named Moshe Dayan and Shimon Peres. And he forms a group called Rafi, which is the United Workers List. Peres and Dayan then leave Ben-Gurion in 67 on the eve of the war so that they can go into a national unity government. Ben-Gurion doesn't care. He absolutely refuses to do so. Again, he stays in power until 1970. Then he says, that's it, I've had it. And I'm going to spend my final years on my kibbutz at Sde Boker. And if some of you might have been there and seen the grave, it's a beautiful setting out there. It's also a beautiful hike through a valley around there, if you've ever gone to that as well.
It's the Grand Canyon of Israel?
Yeah, it's the Grand Canyon. Yeah, I went rappelling down that once. It was very cool. I would not be doing that anytime soon. Let's see what else I can tell you about Ben-Gurion. So he's known as the old man because he's always been in power. This guy was in power from 1920 to 1963. And, by the way, one of Ben-Gurion's tactics was always to say, well, if you don't want me, then I'll resign. And they were so scared of him that they would basically give him his way. He was always threatening to resign. Or he would put in his resignation and they would have a new election and he would get a new mandate. It's very rare, by the way, that any Israeli government lasts 4 years. And if you were reading the Israeli papers this week, they were talking about Netanyahu getting ready for elections again. There's always talk of that type of thing going on, and Ben-Gurion was really the master of that. Now let's take a quick look at some of the things he said, because his impact was so profound. Any volunteers to read this? If not, I'll read it. Yeah, I knew it. He saw himself both as a Zionist and a revolutionary. He was a product of his era. Zionism, in its essence, is a revolutionary movement. Now, in revolutions, there's no compromise, right? The goal was a Jewish state. He would go on and compromise, by the way. He was the one who in 1937 said to the British, yes, we accept your first plan for partition, which is basically the northwestern part of the country coming down to Tel Aviv. And, as some of you may recall, I said last year, had Ben-Gurion had his way, I'm convinced hundreds of thousands of more Jews would have lived, right? There would have been open immigration to that little sliver.
Well, partition, having something was better than nothing.
Right, but Jabotinsky in the revisionist said, no, no, no. we get Jordan too. This is all the ancient land of Israel. And, you know, they said, we're going to settle a couple million Jews here anyway. We're going to need the land. They would have never imagined, by the way, that today there's about 7.8 million people. And I'm just talking about the Jews and the Arabs in pre-67 Israel. You know, there's, what, 3 or 4 million other Arabs in lands controlled by Israel, other than, of course, Gaza. Although there's a whole diplomatic legal argument over that. You know, technically, by the way, as a quick aside, Israel, under international law, is still responsible for the well-being of the citizens of Gaza, or the residents of Gaza, because it never negotiated turning that land over to anyone else. And originally, it took the land from Egypt, which took it from the United Nations. So it's a very complicated legal argument. There's a lot of stuff on the internet, but legally, even though I might disagree with it, Israel is responsible for the well-being of the citizens in Gaza. One could hardly find a revolution that goes deeper than what Zionism wants to do in the life of the Hebrew people. Remember, it's the Hebrew people for many of these guys. It's not the Jewish people, because we're recreating something. We're skipping all of Jewish history, right? All that diaspora, Talmud, ridiculous, so, you know, we're serving other people, we're legally second-class status, like we are in Islam, right? The al-Dhimmi status, like we are in Christianity, right? That we're people of the book too. You're allowed to hurt us but not kill us. We're the Hebrews. This is not merely a revolution of the political and economic structure, but a revolution of the foundation of the personal lives of the members of the people. Revolutions, like communism, change the individual on behalf of the collective. That's the ideology that he's coming out of in Eastern Europe. A very cauldron of ideology in Eastern Europe. The very essence of Zionist thinking about the life of the Jewish people and on Hebrew history is basically revolutionary. He's repeating himself. It is a revolt against a tradition of many centuries. I reject you, rabbis. We don't need you. I'll make a couple political deals with you on the side, like in 1950, when I say your 450 kids in the yeshiva don't have to go into the army, and now it's like 18,000 or something like that. But I don't really need you. It is a revolt against tradition of many centuries, helplessly longing for redemption. You prayed, you waited, you opened the door. In Poland, you didn't finish painting the corner of your room. Messiah never came. Messiah's not going to come. Remember what we talked last week about the secularization of the messianic dream? That's what these guys are after. They're not rejecting, I would say, although they might say, they're not necessarily rejecting Judaism. What they're doing is reinterpreting it for their era. And I would say that every Jewish, you know, belief does that in its time and place. This is just the one that survived. Right? Judaism, Jewish history is filled with different groups that said, no, this is the right approach. And in their era, they served a purpose. Few of them have survived. Where are we? Instead of these sterile and bloodless longings, we substitute a will for realization. Bloodless longings. We're going to have to sacrifice. This isn't going to come so easily. Let's be real here. And they already see sacrifice. Every week, somebody's getting killed. Right? Getting ambushed. I mean, the literature is filled with the danger. This was a dangerous country. It really was. Whoops.
It still is.
Yeah, I was actually just going to say that. Let's see. Ooh, look. Doesn't even need my heat. Got to get me one of these. We substitute a will for realization, an attempt at reconstruction and creativity on the soil of the homeland, the moledet, the homeland. Instead of a people dependent on others, instead of a minority living at the mercy of a majority, we call for a self-sufficient people, master of its own fate. That is pure late 19th, early 20th century nationalism. Right? This could have been written in Serbia. It could have been written in the Ukraine. It could have been written, elsewhere. Prussia, Poland, you name it. Uzbekistan. Instead of a corrupt existence of middlemen hung up in the midair, we call for an independent existence of working people at home on the soil and in a creative economy. it reads like it comes from a socialist or communist manifesto. It really does. And he was of that intellectual bent, right? All these guys did was read. Like I said, and listen to speeches. When you go into his library, it's stunning the diversity of books that he has in there. And, you know, if you next time you go to Israel, I don't know if on our trip, I'll maybe talk to David about that. It would be so cool for us to sit in Ben Gurion's library. You know, it's just, he's an amazing guy.
What middlemen was he?
So middlemen are corrupt existence of middlemen. That would be the shtadlans, the intermediaries, you know, the ones who are the community leaders, the wealthy ones in the shtetl. There were wealthy people in the shtetl who would negotiate on your behalf with the ruler, right? And just like the church had this too, right? In the Middle Ages, you had the church, the wealthy people, and the peasants. Well, the Jews were the peasants, but they always had a few people that made enough money because they can go into things like banking, which Christians are forbidden to do because of lending interest, which Jews are not supposed to do to other Jews as well, but you know everybody forgets that part. And he says, these guys are corrupt. They're skimming off the top. Well, that's business, you know? All right.
Neil, as a 25-year-old,
yeah.
Did he practice Judaism at all?
Say it again?
Did he practice Judaism at all?
He came from a very traditional background. He was 19 when he went to Palestine. He did not practice traditional Judaism at all in Palestine. But for him, he didn't need to because his life was fully Jewish. That was the full realization of what the Jewish people are supposed to be. You know, if you say to somebody, I know this guy. He speaks Hebrew. His first language is Yiddish. He recognizes that, you know, you really shouldn't do much work on Saturday or there aren't official things going on Saturday. And he signed off on a bill that said everything needs to be kosher. You would say, wow, that must be an observant Jew. Not at all. It's just Israel. It's a different paradigm. By the way, this is very different than a guy like Shimon Peres, who always had or has good relationships with ultra-Orthodox rabbis, because Peres was raised in part by his grandfather, who was ultra-Orthodox, who taught him Talmud. And he can talk about that. I've seen some interviews with him about that. By the way, have you guys ever seen, if I remember, I'm going to send this to Michelle, there's about a 4.5-minute video that the Peres Center put out recently about Shimon Peres stepping down as president, and he goes to the unemployment office, and they ask him, you know, what are your skills? He goes, well, I was president of the state. This is nothing practical. You know, well.
It's on YouTube.
You know, yeah, it's hysterical. It's absolutely hysterical. You know, and he's leaving his office, and his secretary says, have you thought about what you're going to do? He goes, I don't know. I'll call a few friends, maybe, you know. And everywhere they go, he goes, no, you know, you just don't have the experience that's practical. You were in politics. All you did was scream at each other. We need something to get done here. Totally worth 4.5 minutes of your life. This is real important. We talked about Jabotinsky's views on Arabs. Does anybody remember what that was last week?
The Iron Wall.
The Iron Wall. Excellent. That was one of his essays. Jabotinsky's views on Arabs were, we need to live with the Arabs. We need to be democratic about it. They can't be a majority in this country. That was the bottom line. He basically said, we're going to be 60%, they're going to be 40%. We're not going to allow them to be more than that, but we're going to give them every right. But he was absolutist about it, as he was with everything. Ben-Gurion evolved. So let's see, in 1919, he says, everybody sees the problem in relations between the Jews and the Palestinian Arabs, but not everybody sees that there's no solution to it. Right? Some would make that argument today. Right, and I candidly have argued that some problems don't have solutions that are seen in the present, but they all must be managed. And just as a commercial, I think that Israel doesn't always do such a good job in managing that part of the problem. There is no solution. It is what it is. The conflict between the interests of the Jews and the interests of the Palestinian Arabs in Palestine cannot be resolved by sophisms. People saying things. I don't know any Arabs who would agree to Palestine. Hang on a second. Palestine being ours, even if we learn Arabic. and I have no need to learn Arabic. He did learn a little Arabic, by the way. This is a little early, 1919. He's 29 at this point. On the other hand, I don't see why Mustafa should learn Hebrew. Very condescending. There's a national question here. We want the country to be ours. The Arabs want the country to be theirs. Relatively early, before any of the riots of 20, 21, 29, and 36 to 39, he's saying, we have two competing nationalist ideologies here. Only one of them is going to win, and you know whose side I'm on. A lot of people make that argument today. So then, and that was, by the way, before the Versailles Peace Conference, when the Zionists sent the delegation to say, all these countries are getting, all these peoples are getting their countries, because the Ottoman Empire is being carved up, and the Habsburg Empire was being carved up, and the Prussian Empire was being carved up, and the Russian Empire had fallen, and so on and so on. It's time for the Jews. So then, 1947 at the UN, he says, this is our native land. It's certain he's going to be prime minister by this point already, when the state is declared finally. It is not as birds of passage that we return to it. It's a nice biblical allusion, nice literary allusion, but it's situated in an area engulfed by Arabic-speaking people, mainly followers of Islam. Now, if ever, we must do more than make peace with them. We must achieve collaboration and alliance on equal terms. Remember what Arab delegations from Palestine and its neighbors say in the General Assembly and in other places. Talk of Arab-Jewish unity, amity sounds fantastic. For the Arabs, do not wish it. They will not sit at the same table with us. They want to treat us as they do the Jews of Baghdad, Cairo, and Damascus. There had been riots in Baghdad in World War II against the Jews. Cairo and Damascus, periodically, there were problems as well. So he's coming to the world leaders, and he's saying to them, look, we have to get along with them. We understand there's about 500 million of them and 650,000 of us. Israel at its founding had 650,000 Jews. Tel Aviv today has 500,000 Jews. And I'm not talking about Metro Tel Aviv. But they won't do it. So we're calling on you to help us. Now there's all types of things in the air before independence. One is that the United Nations is going to extend the mandate and take it on itself and protect the land and the Jewish people there. The other is that the British are going to stay. Ben-Gurion's not really sure of this. Nobody's really sure what the British are going to do. Some people thought that the British were going to pull out, and then the fighting would get bad, and they would be invited to come back to keep the peace, which the British would have loved. Maybe, I'm not so sure, but it would have raised their prestige because they got battered in Palestine. I mean, they had a bunch of little pishers bloodying them. And that wasn't so good for their reputation, and their empire was falling apart at that time.
Is that what's happening to our government right now?
Be more specific.
That we're getting a battering overseas?
We're not really getting a battering overseas because our troops are not getting slaughtered or killed the way some of the British were. Remember, Irgun was kidnapping British soldiers and hanging them. There were all types of stuff going on. I mean, I understand what you're saying.
Our presence has contracted, but we've lost a lot of service.
Yes, we did, but a whole other conversation.
It is a parallel.
There are parallels.
To not achieve military objectives, but simply trying to provide an administration with based on military power against a native population that has no interest and has internal rivalries. I mean,
okay.
It's the same thing as Iraq.
Man.
Same thing as Vietnam.
History repeats itself.
And Afghanistan.
History repeats itself. The difference here, really, is that you didn't have a country that was being taken over by anybody. You had a country or countries that were being created. There would be more of a parallel if Kurdistan were declared, for example, and there was some fighting going on there. And then southern Iraq is Shiite. And northern and north, kind of northwestern Iraq is Sunni. So I see what you guys are saying, but I just don't want to go there. All right. So let me see if I have. Yeah. So Ben-Gurion was a remarkable figure. He started the precedent of the prime minister always being the defense minister. I shouldn't say always, because Ehud Barak was defense minister for a while for Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres. But in general terms, most prime ministers, they either handpick a defense minister or they're the defense minister themselves.
I mean, what, Moshe Dayan was the defense minister?
Well, he was defense minister from like 67 to 74. He started with Eshkol and then Golda Meir. Yeah, absolutely. And he had been chief of staff, and we're going to get to him when we get to the 56th war in depth. Fascinating, fascinating figure. All right. Any questions on Ben-Gurion? Really, and I think I put a thing on the syllabus that I urge you to read Michael Bar-Zohar's book on Ben-Gurion. It's a great book.
Relationship with Begin.
Right. Oh, that's great. They didn't see eye to eye until the first week, the last week in May of 1967. Right? So when they hated each other's guts because Begin worshipped Jabotinsky. Begin was actually, you know, afraid of Jabotinsky in many regards. Jabotinsky dies of a heart attack in 1940 at a summer camp in upstate New York. Begin gets to Palestine in 1943. Shortly after that, he comes with the Anders Free Polish Army, it's called, because the British had invited them to come down. He's relieved of duty at his request. He goes and heads the Irgun. You know, they hated each other left and right. Left and right. And it really, and basically, Ben-Gurion wouldn't talk to Begin other than to yell at him from the Knesset that he was a Nazi, which he did at various times. That was not an unusual insult in Israeli politics. You couldn't get politics. You couldn't get away with it today, but for some reason in the 40s, 50s, and into the 60s, you could get away with calling each other a Nazi. I guess in some regards, the scope of the destruction of the Holocaust didn't sink in for decades. It probably still hasn't sunk in terms of the way it's altered modern Jewish history. So, the eve of the Six-Day War, the nation is a wreck, and a delegation goes to Ben-Gurion, late May. Remember, the war starts on June 5th. And they say to him, we've formed a national unity government, we've got Likud, or Herut, actually in the government now, we've brought in Rafi, which is Moshe Dayan and Shimon Peres. We would like for you to step back and be prime minister because it would instill confidence in the people and the army. And, you know, Ben-Gurion basically says, look, I'm 82 years old. I'm not going to do that. He chats with Begin, first time they've really chatted in decades, and he writes down in his diaries, had I known that he was such a gentleman then, I would have had a different relationship with him. Now, one thinks that Ben-Gurion has mellowed and Begin has refined himself in large regard. Begin, if anything, was a refined, cultured individual that believed in democracy very, very strongly. Remember, Begin, we mentioned it last week, is the one who said, no, we're not going to fight back against the Haganah, even though they're helping the British hunt us down, what was called the Saison, or the Season. Begin really helped prevent civil war in the Yishuv at that time. Not that many of his followers weren't very bitter, very, very bitter, but that's the relationship between them. And you're nodding your head, so you've heard this story before,
yeah,
I assume.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, where'd you hear it? You remember?
Wikipedia.
Yeah, it must be true. You know, I do look at Wikipedia for things, but if it's not sourced, I won't use it.
Yeah.
You know, if I can't trace it.
I start there and you branch off.
Right,
that's
right.
Sharon, did he have a relationship with Sharon or the same type of thing?
Which one? Ben-Gurion?
Yeah.
Ben-Gurion loved Sharon.
Really?
Sharon was his protege. And we'll talk more about Sharon later, of course, but just to give you, because you mentioned Ben-Gurion, Sharon was the apple of his eye because he was the modern Hebrew warrior. He was born in the land, a place called Kfar Malal. He had no inhibitions of the diaspora. He was, you know, out there, and he was bold and daring. And there are many pictures in the 50s in particular of Sharon and Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion promoted him. He thought that he was just, you know, one of the great ones. Absolutely. And Sharon is a complicated figure, by the way. Everybody thinks of Sharon as being the architect of housing and all that. He started out in labor. He, of course, withdrew from the Gaza Strip in August 2005. I don't know if it was you guys or another group I told that when Sharon gave an interview in 2001 to the Israeli media, his first year as prime minister, you always bring in the editors of the newspapers just before Rosh Hashanah. And he sighed and he said, you know, things look different from in here. So he was not an unreflective individual. I'm actually reading a book about him now by a guy named David Landau, who used to be editor of Haaretz. It's just called Arik Sharon. It's actually surprisingly not written that well, but there's a lot of good, interesting stuff in there. There's not a lot of good biographies on Sharon out yet. His son wrote one, too. I'm not even going to bother with that. Once, like 20 years ago, I read a pro-Sharon biography and then an anti-Sharon biography right after each other. That was right after the Lebanon War. And that gave me both perspectives. And, you know, I'll tell you this about Sharon. Apparently, his soldiers loved him. He was great for his soldiers. They loved him. His superiors hated him.
His people who worked for him loved him.
Right. Right.
He wrote an autobiography like 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, it's called Warrior, I believe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I see there's one murder where Jill's head, too.
I see the Ben Gurion. Oh, yeah, Sharon.
And the Michael Zohar book is here, too.
Oh, yeah, great. So who wrote the Sharon book?
It's Anita Miller, Jordan Miller, St. Louis, St. Louis.
Don't know.
If anyone wants to.
Yeah, sure, we'll you take it. We'll tell Karen. We'll leave her a note, the librarian.
Another Ben Gurion.
Yeah, Ben Gurion's just a fascinating figure. I mean, Herzl started the whole deal. Ben Gurion made it a reality. Ben Gurion was the doer. And, you know, in some regards, Herzl was the dreamer, the intellect, the Luftmann. Ben Gurion was the guy who literally from the ground up built the Labor Party, you know, the apparatus of labor. And he had a single vision. All right. I just mentioned the Cézanne. Let's talk for a moment about the Palmach. One of the things that was very positive for the Jews that came out of World War II, if anything could be positive from that, you know, horrible overall horrors, was the founding of something called the Palmach. Now, the Haganah had been founded a little earlier. Remember, we had had Jewish defense efforts since 1909, 1910 with Hashomer, or the Guardian, and their job was to sit on horses and ride around the kibbutzim in the Galilee and make sure that Arabs weren't, you know, stealing sheep and, you know, cattle and what have you. Then we, by 1920, kind of the founding of the Haganah, which literally means, Haganah means defense. So Ha-Haganah, the Haganah, the defense. They created, in 1941, a strike force, a lightning quick strike force. These are basically commandos. Now, what was interesting about this, of the many things that are interesting, is that this was the first paid Jewish army since probably the Bar Kokhba revolt, assuming they got paid in something, 132 to 135 CE. There were about 2,000, do I have 2,000 or 1,500? It's about 2,200, man, by 48. There was roughly about 1,500, 2,000 people by the mid to late 40s. This was a full-time force. They lived on various kibbutzim, particularly again in the Galilee, that's where the majority of the kibbutzim were. And are. They trained together. They got involved in all types of things. They also worked with the British, which is very important. Remember, the British needed allies during World War II. They knew they really couldn't count on the Arabs because the Mufti was broadcasting from Berlin. Remember the Haj Husseini, we talked about our pal last week, telling them to revolt. And there was a lot of sympathy for that. And there was fear that Rommel was going to sweep across Egypt and the Sinai Desert and take Palestine on his way to taking Lebanon, their way to taking Lebanon and Syria and then oil fields in Baghdad in Iraq and elsewhere. So they turned to the Jews who helped them. And the Jews helped them fight the Vichy French in Syria and Lebanon. Right, this is where Moshe Dayan loses an eye. I don't remember if it's 41 or 42 from a ricochet. And I have a picture of him coming up without his eye patch. I think it's in this batch of stuff. So they had two jobs, defending the settlements from the Arabs and defending the Shuv, or the community, from the Germans. We mentioned last week that there was fears that the British were going to pull out and go north, and there was kind of a Masada plan, that's what they called it, that they were going to use the caves around the Carmel Mountain north of Haifa and engage in guerrilla warfare against the Germans. 1949, it was disbanded. Very controversial. In 1948, Ben-Gurion signed an order merging the Haganah, Etzel, which was Begin's group, and the Stern Gang, which is, I can't remember what it is in Hebrew. Stern Gang. Okay, well, which was the Way right-wing gang. The Way right-wing group. That's where Yitzhak Shamir comes in. Shamir, by the way, spends time in Mauritania in a British jail around this time, late 40s, because the British captured him doing some what they call terrorist activities, and they sent him and others there. He doesn't make his way back to Israel until about 1950. So, 49, the fear is that these guys, and mostly guys, there were a handful of women involved, are an army within an army, and they're loyal to their commanders, and they're not loyal enough to Ben-Gurion or the state. And Ben-Gurion says, this is the potential seeds of revolt. I'm going to disband their units and mix them in with other units. They didn't like this. Yitzhak Rabin didn't like this. He was commander of the Harel Brigade. No one liked it because they were really the elite of the army at that time. It was a good move, but it was a very difficult move at that time. But the Palmach is legendary these days. By the way, when you drive to Jerusalem today and you see on the side on the left the wrecked vehicles from one of the convoys that went up to Jerusalem, that was guarded by a Palmach unit. And ultimately, Rabin and the Harel Brigade got a unit, got a convoy through. But that's the Palmach. And I just wanted to show you, I found this, I love this, the Palmach song. Like everything else, they had their own song and esprit de corps and what have you. Though the storm is ever mounting, still our heads remain unbowed. We are ready to obey all commands. The Palmach will win, we vowed. From Metula to the Negev, from the desert to the plain, all our youth defend the homeland, till we bring it peace again. In the eagle's path we follow, over mountain tracks we go, among stony heights and caverns, we are seeking out the foe. When you summon us to battle, we will be there first by day or night. We are ready when you give the command. The Palmach will march in might. So, they even had a marching song. I don't know if that's sweatshirts. But
the Palmach is a museum, right?
Yes.
Next to the Yitzhak Rabin Center.
Right, in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, what's very interesting about it is it's not really trying to tell history. It's trying to infuse or recreate that sense of esprit de corps,
yes,
or spirit, or the bonds that were created between these, mostly men, but some women, mm-hmm, that participated, and their commitment to the state and their sacrifices. It's really interesting. And
yeah,
also, in the Rabin Center, his museum spends a fair amount of time talking about the decision that was made to disband the Palmach, and how difficult it was. And it was not like Etzel, because there was no ideological difference. It was just the idea of having a separate fighting force that,
right,
Ben-Gurion saw. But for these people, it was their, it'd be like saying, I don't know what to compare. When Sherry Zion and, was it?
Jacob
merged, and you know, there were all these good reasons for it, but you had maybe one group saying, this was our home, this was our, we
absolutely
have, you know, a whole culture here that we can't just,
Absolutely. I haven't been in the Rabin Center yet, actually, but I'd like to go there on my next trip to Israel. But you remind me of another interesting thing as well, that this is not the only time that Ben-Gurion does this. Some of you know of, I think it's in June 48, you know the story of the Altalena, in which the Irgun, the state has already declared, There's actually a ceasefire. There's actually two ceasefires in the Civil War. And a group, a shipment of arms is coming from Europe for the Irgun units. There were separate units for the Irgun. And Begin says to Ben-Gurion, we're bringing this stuff in. And Ben-Gurion says, fine, we'll take it, we'll unload it, and we'll disperse it to all the army. And Begin says, no, we want to give it to our units. So Ben-Gurion says, no, you're not going to give it to your units. I'm not going to allow that. So Begin says, yeah, we're going to do it. So what happens is basically this, and we'll go into it in detail, I think, next week is a little more, because it's during the war itself. To make a long story short, the now Israel Defense Forces is set up on the beach, and it fires on the Al-Kalina, and Begin's on the ship. And there are fires, there are explosions, you know, Begin won't get off the ship until everyone gets off. He basically escapes with his life. Guess who was commanding the group on the beach? Anyone know?
Rabin.
Yitzhak Rabin. So these grudges go deep. These grudges go really deep. One ostensibly tried to kill the other. One orders. Nonetheless, if you were Begin, you wouldn't say, well, you know, he was just following orders. All right? So Ben-Gurion correctly had a vision of a unified military. He said, that is the only way that we are going to have a sane state. At the same time, interestingly enough, a lot of people don't focus on this. You know, under the United Nations mandate, Jerusalem was an international zone. And there was going to be a sliver, a corridor, going out to Tel Aviv or Haifa. I think it was to Tel Aviv. So Etzel and Irgun had independent units operating in the Jerusalem area. And they weren't listening to anybody. And they later had to get them under control as well. So there was a lot of ferment going on. You have a lot of people who are very ideologically motivated. And one of the other things, one of the fascinating legacies of this era, is that you have a lot of people who survive by beating the system, which is also akin, I think, in some regards to the Russian Jews or Soviet Jews who have come to Israel. You survive by beating the system. So when you have your full state, and your state basically says pay income taxes, or do this or do that, you seek ways around it. There's a psychological, cultural approach to life in Israel about beating the system, which worked so well and made so much sense when the British were controlling the state. It was a very, was, and I would argue, is a very difficult transition. And at the same time, we say Israelis are independent-minded, you know, nothing stops them. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. You know, so, all right. Where are we doing on time? We're doing fine. All right, the struggle over immigration. As all of this is going on, there's a lot going on in terms of immigration. That's fine. This is a fascinating picture. Yisrael Meir Lau. Anybody know who he is?
Didn't become a rabbi?
He became chief rabbi of Israel. Now he's chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. This is him as a young, I think he was 8 years old, if I'm correct. He's a Holocaust survivor. His son is actually chief rabbi for Ashkenazi chief rabbi today. By the way, you know that the rabbinate system in Israel has no precedence in Jewish history. In some regards, it's ridiculous. There's a chief Ashkenazi and a chief Sephardi rabbi. The British set it up just to make every community happy. They gave everybody something. In the past, the Jews, including in Israel, had always had, you know, a separate Sephardic and Ashkenazi community. And the rabbis talked to each other, and you know, you followed who you chose to follow, and what have you. But the British institutionalized it. Hundreds of thousands of Jews are languishing in DP camps in Europe, in displaced persons camps. No Sephardim are coming in, right? That can't happen until the state is declared. The British aren't allowing it. If you remember, in 1939, the British solution to mollifying the Arabs' anger, which was constant over the decades, was we're going to allow 15,000 Jews a year into this country for 5 years. That's 75,000 people. And then, if the Arabs agree, we'll allow each year what is viable according to the economic capacity of the country. Nobody knows what economic capacity is. Not only that, and again, I take a look at today, can you imagine the British saying, sure, we'll allow 5 million Jews in so you can have 7.8 million people here? Obviously, they didn't understand economic capacity. Holocaust survivors had nowhere to go. We have the U.S. President, Truman, lobbying the British for what's called the Grady Morrison Commission comes back from Palestine. They recommend 100,000 survivors are immediately allowed to come in. The British are still saying no. The British basically say no until the last minute. There are illegal waves of immigration coming in. Now, you know, it's 50 at a time, 150 at a time. We know the story of the ship, the Exodus, which sailed from Baltimore, originally as the USS Warfield. We have a little bit of smuggling coming through the mountains in the north, but not that much. Some of you may have been outside of Haifa. There's, I think it's in Atlit, there's an illegal immigration museum with the ships, called the Af Al Pi Museum. Despite it all, we're going to keep coming here. In the camps in Europe, the Zionists sent all their emissaries to teach Hebrew, to teach songs. Ben-Gurion would go and tour the camps. Remember, the state's not founded until 3 years after the end of the war. Some people are living in DP camps until 1950 and 1951. Not many, but some. But there are hundreds of thousands of people, and they keep having to be moved around, by the way, because the Russians are cementing East Germany. You know, the global situation is changing. Some tried to go home to Poland, but there was a pogrom in Kielce and places like this. They find that they can't go home. They say there's only one place they want to go. The truth is, if many of them could have gotten into the United States, they would have come here. All right, just like if many of the Soviet Jews could have gone to the United States, they would have gone there. And we talked a little bit about that. But for many of them, it is Palestine. They already have some family there. This is what they know is free. And it's very difficult. Let me take a look and see if I have our first video set up. Illegal immigrants in Palestine. Here we go. Let's see. I don't know if this one has volume. No, so let's just watch it a little bit. It's a total of 4 minutes, so not the best. Try and imagine, if you will, a ship like this. And these ships were in bad shape. They were in really bad shape. Trying to make it to Palestine. And then they would get caught. And then the British didn't know what to do. Right? Some of them, by the way, are being sneaked into the communities, into the kibbutzim. Some of them need medical care. They're all hungry. You know, the British have a public relations nightmare on their hands. The British really took a beating in Palestine.
Is that Paul Newman?
I can spot a Jew from a mile away. Look in my eye. That's my favorite line in that movie. I mean, these are really ragtag people. You know, they haven't been on the boat that long, probably a few days, which makes you realize even more so how ragtag they are. You know, and like all of us, I think of relatives that I never met that were wiped out in the Holocaust, and maybe some of them made it to Israel, I don't know. The Irgun would try and break these people out of the temporary holding cells or, you know, with barbed wire that they would be in. And this was not an uncommon occurrence in the port of Haifa or off the shores of Tel Aviv. I mean, if you were the British government, what would you do? I mean, I ask you, anybody having a thought, what would you do? You know, from their perspective, it's a nightmare.
It's like a cattle court.
Yeah. And they were very upset that there were comparisons to the Holocaust. And we'll see next week, by the way, some of the guys in particular, unfortunately, after the country came into being, they were thrust into the battlefield. They were given weapons, they didn't speak Hebrew, they didn't understand commands, they were cut down. And particularly in the Battle of Lutrun.
The DDT.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I looked at this video and I was like, wow, this is very descriptive. And it really gives you a picture. Some ships the British troops had to storm because the people barricaded themselves on it.
What are they searching for?
Weapons. Knives. I don't know what they're doing there. It might be a medical check.
Yeah, this is in Palestine.
Yeah.
So they've already been able to.
Well, the British
avoid,
would.
They've already been able to avoid Cyprus. Or,
no, what happens is the British Navy comes up to the ships when there's a certain amount of miles or kilometers off, and they escort them in.
And then they remove them.
Right.
To Cyprus.
Right. Some go to Cyprus. Some are in camps in Palestine for a while. Some are taken back to Germany. You know, it's a DP camps there.
Is this a British film?
Yes. Yes, there's actually some really cool British websites about our time in Palestine and stuff like that that I go through periodically. Let me get the light.
I think something that was mentioned by Shapira is about the DP camps, and how the DP camps were really mixed, and there were Germans in the DP.
I recently read a book about all the Germans and
their
allies.
So that enemies were together.
Yes.
In the DP camps, and it took a long time for the Allies to realize that you just couldn't keep these people together.
Right. I actually recently read a book. I think it was called Unholy Alliance. It was about the Germans and their allies who tried to evade being identified. And they were in these camps with Jews and with other people. And it was the book was really about how the Vatican helped them escape to South America. And it was really interesting. No love lost for Vatican officials at that point.
Gee, make them a saint and then they'll be okay.
That's right. It must be good to be a saint. All right. Let me just one more. So here's another one. But the Theodore Herzl... you know, the names of the ships were carefully choreographed, right? It's written in English for the media that's going to be there when they come in. Like the Exodus, they choose that name on purpose. They choose the Theodore Herzl on purpose. Here you go. They tried to run a British blockade. Two passengers were killed. By the time these people got on the boats and were headed to Palestine, they were radicalized because they said, we're not going back to a DP camp, and we don't care what you do to us, because it's not going to be worse than what happened to us there. You know, back in Germany, in the Holocaust. All right, let's take our quick break now, because we're at a good stopping point. And we'll start up in 5 minutes.
David,
because
we talked to him, and he said he was coming, and then we'll pick him up.
The sound system's not working. All right, so we've been covering a lot. Last week we led up to basically 47. Now we're at 47. Just as a preview, next week we do the War of Independence. And then we get into the apparatus of the state and what it meant. And, you know, we keep making reference to how things are today because of what they were then. And we're going to keep doing that. The first thing we have to look at, of course, is the first independent Jewish state since 135 CE. This was the plan, as they say, the best laid plans of mice and men. November 1947, the British in late winter, actually, of 47, went to the United Nations and said, no mas, we can't do this anymore. This is not working. We can't win. We've spent about 30 years here. They all hate each other, and we can't police them anymore. And there's all types of allegations that the British are favoring the Arabs, which they are, for the most part. Although not all the British. Remember, we had our buddy Ord Wingate in the late 30s, who was helping train the special night squads, and he really taught a lot of battle tactics. So we're giving our mandate, which we got from the League of Nations in 1923, even though our civil law started in 1920, back to its successor, the United Nations. You, the United Nations, have to decide what to do. Well, there's no shortage of plans. We've looked at compromises really since, well, we've looked at compromises all along, but since 37, for the last decade, we've had a series of formal compromises, and there are a lot of informal ones as well. So the United Nations says, fine, we're going to split the country in half. We are going to have the Jewish main area, the settlement is here. We're going to give the Jews all this, because basically that's a throwaway. I mean, it really meant nothing in many regards. All of this is going to be Arab. We're going to give Jews this, even though there are a lot of Jewish kibbutzim and moshavim in here. I'm really not quite sure why they drew it the way they drew it, although certainly giving Gaza was a good idea. And Jerusalem is Jerusalem, so it's going to have special international status. Right? That's where the United Nations is basically going to rule what's going on. And in theory, it looks good because the Jews have a port up in Haifa, and they have Tel Aviv, and there's going to be about 30-35% of the Jewish area is going to be Arab. Not much, about 10% of the Arab area is going to be Jewish, and Jerusalem is going to be Jerusalem, and it's still going to be one land west of the river. That was the plan. You notice that the Golan Heights really wasn't in there, of course. There were some border adjustments up here. The Jews accepted with reluctance. They basically said, you know, we've got to get hundreds of thousands of Holocaust survivors out of Europe. We have to create a state. We have to create a stronghold, a foothold, and we'll go from there. Everybody knew war was coming. Everybody knew war was coming. Certainly the Arabs knew it, and certainly Ben-Gurion and the Jews knew it. In the interim, until what was going to be midnight between May 14th and May 15th, I never know, what would that be? What's that midnight between May 14th and 15th? What day is that? Anybody know? I can never figure that out.
It's midnight?
Yeah, but what date? So, it's 11:59 p.m., May 14th.
Yeah, so
the next minute, is that May 15th?
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
That's the story.
I'm never quite sure. You know, no, it's... I just can't quite figure that out. Okay. I'm like that. So...
Be careful
meanwhile,
that when you're flying.
What?
Be careful of that when you're flying.
Yes. Meanwhile, the British still control everything. There is some evidence that the British are taking weapons away from Jews when they find them, but not taking away from Arabs. The British weren't unbiased against the Jews by any stretch of the imagination. I had a friend whose father unfortunately recently passed away. He was in the Haganah, and he would tell me that, you know, the Nazis, the Arabs, whatever, we really hated the British. We really hated. My father-in-law tells me stories about as a little kid in Palestine and Jerusalem, he would throw rocks at the British soldiers with his buddies and then run, and the British soldiers would run after them and beat them up. You know, that's what they did. They really, really hated each other. No one was really going to accept this other than the King of Jordan, who we're going to get to in a little bit. Everybody was preparing to invade Palestine. And remember, it's not as if this was a land free of violence. There was ongoing violence and spasms of violence. Again, we've had major riots in 20, 21, 29, 36 to 39, and those are just the major violence, the major waves of violence. This is the era known as the Civil War in Palestine. From November 47 to May of 48, we start having Arab volunteers from other countries sneaking in, particularly in the north. Coming over various borders. They're buoyed by initial success.
These are the ISIS of yesteryear.
If you want, yeah. I mean, they're motivated, they're young, they're looking for an adventure, and of course, they're going to beat up on the Jews and the British. Right? They're going to get the colonialists. Because in the Arab world, the Jewish settlement was seen by many as a colonial enterprise. A lot of the Arabs said, the British are just leaving to give it to the Jews who are going to run it for them. Right? And of course, what you still hear today, why should we pay for the sins of what the Europeans did to the Jews? You know, we didn't do the Holocaust. This is our country. And of course, it's a much more mixed bag than that, because as the Jews came in, the economy raised, and there were more jobs for Arabs, and more Arabs started immigrating to Israel, which increased the Arab population. There was a lot of Arab-Jewish cooperation. We know from the Hebron riots in 1929 that some of the Arabs there saved Jews. They saved them. So it's not as if everybody hates each other, and there are peace efforts amongst the people. Remember, we talked about the Ichud movement of Martin Buber and Judah Magnus, for two peoples in one land and what have you. There are efforts of that.
Well, to be Jewish and to try to accommodate the Arabs, that's one thing, but if you're Arab and you try to accommodate the Jews, that can be deadly dangerous.
Right, and in fact, we see that today. It's actually in the Palestinian Authority. It is against the law to sell land to Jews. And I don't know if it's still the case, but under Arafat, you got the death penalty for that, for selling land to Jews. Now, and land, we haven't talked that much about it in this course. We might have mentioned it last week. The issue of land ownership, which is so key to everything, is that if I farmed my land for 400, 500 years, it's mine. But what if a guy in Istanbul owns the deed to the land and sells it to Shlomo from the Jewish Agency for Israel, and he shows up at my door one day and says, "You got a month to get off the land. I own the land." You're not going to be a happy camper. You're not going to be a happy camper. Now, he's not wrong, and you're not wrong in many regards. And that's why one of the underlying themes of this course and the whole issue of Israel in general is two competing nationalities for one land. Right, two competing nationalities for one land. So this is from the Arab Higher Committee, which was formed a little before that to unite against the Jewish coming Jewish state. Right, because there's 6 months now that we know a Jewish state is going to come into being. So this is in February. The Palestinian Arabs consider any attempt by Jewish people or by whatever power or group of power to establish a Jewish state in an Arab territory to be an act of aggression that will be resisted by force. All right? There's no doubt about how we're going to respond. We will fight. The Arabs, by the way, that wanted to live in peace with the Jews, many of them fled. They went to Beirut. They went to Damascus. They knew war was coming, particularly Christian middle and upper middle class people, particularly Muslims in the Nashashibi clan. I think we mentioned last week there are two main clans. There's the Nashashibis and the Husseinis. The Husseinis are radicalized, the Nashashibis, and there's, I don't know how many thousands and thousands of relatives in these clans. The Nashashibis are more moderate. And for many years they had gone back and forth in terms of trading terms of who was going to be the mayor of Jerusalem. Because Jerusalem was, of course, and is the most important city in the country. The prestige of the United Nations would be better served by abandoning this plan and by not imposing such an injustice. The Palestinian Arabs make a grave declaration before the UN, before God, and before history that they will never submit to any power that comes to Palestine to impose a partition. The only way to establish a partition is to get rid of them all, men, women, and children. No mercy. Now, I'm not telling you every Arab believed this. I'm telling you, and I could find Jewish sources that say similar things about Arabs. Right? And you can do that today, too. Right? Often people say to me, can you believe that such and such minister from the Palestinian Authority said such and such. And I said, well, did you hear what the Minister of Transportation said in Israel? You know, it's pretty bad stuff. This, however, comes from an organized group with weapons. That's a bad thing. So meanwhile, the Galilee in particular is a dangerous place at this point. Where there are British forces, it's a little safer. Tel Aviv in general, not always, but in general, is safe. You know, sometimes there's some violence in Tel Aviv, but not that much. Ironically, we wouldn't really see violence in Tel Aviv until the mid-90s with the bus bombings. Around this time, a very sad chapter in Zionist history came into being. Deir Yassin. Any of you guys familiar with Deir Yassin?
Yeah.
What do you know about it?
It's a town that's on the way to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
It was strategic in location.
Absolutely.
Supposedly there was a fair amount of anti-Semitism. That was not unique.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they wanted to send a message.
Right.
They went overboard.
You want to add anything to that?
No, I mean, that is the focus of Arab and Palestinian hatred of Israel. And
absolutely.
Always using that as an example of what Jews can do.
Right. So Deir Yassin, of course, is a little more complicated than that. And by the way, I put a note up here. I cannot independently validate the source of this photo. It comes from the group called Occupied Palestine. It says these are Irgun Luchi and Haganah fighters attacking Deir Yassin. Looks like it could be. You know, I just don't have a better source than that. I couldn't find a more illustrative picture. I found a lot of graphic stuff of after Deir Yassin, what took place there. So let me give you some little background information on it. It's a village about 3 miles outside of Jerusalem. It's still there today. It's like many Palestinian villages, it's been there for many hundreds of years. On April 9th, about 120 Irgun Luchi and a few Haganah men, not many, it was mainly Irgun and Luchi operation, or Lechi operation.
That's the name of the Stern
yeah.
Gang.
Stern Gang, yeah, yeah. The Stern Gang. And Stern, ironically, was killed in 42 in a shootout with the British. Or, well, Stern people say that he was assassinated in cold blood by the British, and the British say he tried to escape and they killed him. They attacked the village because, as you said, they wanted it for strategic purposes. Now, they also wanted to send a message. The people in this village had apparently or allegedly been involved in some attacks against Jews. By the end, about 100 to 120 people had been killed in that village. Men, women, and children. It's a very, very ugly type of thing. We're still not quite sure who gave the order to attack and when to attack. The Haganah denounced it right away. And this is not unusual. If you remember, the Haganah, even though they knew about it, the Haganah also denounced the bombing of the King David Hotel, even though they had given approval for it, for that operation. So Ben-Gurion condemned it. Interestingly enough, the Jewish Agency for Israel, or for Palestine, sent a condolence letter to King Abdullah I, the King of Jordan. Abdullah always had and coveted had eyes for the West Bank, and Jerusalem in particular. You know, Abdullah, including his now great-grandson, who is another King Abdullah in Jordan, are direct descendants of Muhammad, so they claim, the Prophet Muhammad. And because of that, they believe they have special responsibility to the Muslim holy shrines in Jerusalem, the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So because of that, they've always wanted Jerusalem. And we'll talk about it in a few minutes, but he had basically always met with the Jewish leadership and said, I just want the West Bank and Jerusalem. You know, I won't move against you if you let me have that, which of course they weren't so in agreement. Benny Morris, I don't know if any of you know his name, he's a noted as well as controversial and very, very good Israeli historian. He's written a lot of books. Said, the almost important immediate effect of the atrocity and the media campaign that followed it was how one started to report the fear felt in Palestinian towns and villages, and later the panic fleeing from them. So, in many regards, if the mission was to instill fear in the Arabs, it worked, if that was the goal. However, there was a revenge attack, and many of you have heard of this. There was a convoy driving to Hadassah Hospital, and that convoy shortly after that was attacked by Arab irregulars, and 79 Jews were killed. Many of them were doctors and nurses. 13 British soldiers were nearby, but they didn't intervene. Now, I can be nice and say they didn't intervene because they would have been overwhelmed, or I can be mean and say they didn't intervene because they didn't care. And to be honest with you, I haven't read enough memoirs from British soldiers to know, you know, one way or another, if that's the case. But what you're seeing, more importantly, is this cycle of violence. And everything is leading up to May 15th, where there's going to be an invasion of five armies and volunteers from other Arab countries as well, of Palestine. But there's already civil war going on. As this civil war is going on, more and more Palestinians are fleeing. They don't want to be caught in the middle of the war. The Jews aren't fleeing because they have nowhere to go. I can guarantee you that if Lebanon were a Jewish state, many of the Jews would have gone there. It would be hard to believe otherwise. So as we see that sad chapter, we have another sad chapter. Any of you ever been out to Gush Etzion? Yeah, I have a friend from Baltimore, actually. He grew up in this congregation. He lives out there. And I spent the Shabbat out there with him once. It's a pretty area. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. Early on, Gush, which means the block of Etzion, was formed as, I think it was three kibbutzim in the 1920s. And remember, when we think of forming a kibbutz, quote-unquote, out there, that was just part of the regular country back then. That was Palestine. That wasn't, oh my God, it's on the West Bank. You know, there was really no such thing as the West Bank at that point. There's four settlements. It's on the road from Jerusalem to Hebron, or Hebron. Most people who live there work in Jerusalem. Many people who work in government offices live out there. Primarily modern Orthodox Jews live out there. There's a famous yeshiva out there, the Har Etzion Yeshiva. Some of you may have heard of Rabbi Yehuda Amital. Amital was this, he died a few years ago, was this brilliant guy who sought to unite the people of Israel. He started that yeshiva out there and lived out there. He was the one that Peres chose after Rabin was assassinated to be the minister of Jewish unity in the short-lived Peres government. And he is the founder of something called the Meimad movement, which is a religious peace movement in Israel. And Rabbi Melchior is his successor, Michael Melchior, who served in Knesset several terms as well. So it's the Gush Etzion is surrounded by Arab villages. It had about 400 inhabitants at that time. In December 47, Haganah forces came to bolster the defenses there because it was an important point on the road toward Jerusalem. If you controlled that, Arab armies couldn't get through to Jerusalem. That's obviously what they wanted, to control that road. However, this was a Palmach division. On January 8th, the women and children were evacuated by the British because the British said, you're going to get slaughtered if you don't leave. The men stayed behind. Armed convoys kept coming from Jerusalem every few weeks with both weapons and food to try and reinforce them. Remember, one of the things that's going on now is because everybody knows that the Jewish state is coming, that the apparatus is coming into being. So we have military tactical affairs, and we have military supplies going on, and there's building and building toward this Jewish state. Unfortunately, one famous convoy called the Lamed Hay, or the 35, were going. Does anybody know this story? The 35 soldiers were coming out to Gush Etzion. They came across an Arab shepherd, and they had a debate. Do we kill him? Because if we don't, he's going to give up our position. He's going to go to that village and tell them, and we know the environment, the irregulars are going to come out here with their guns and kill us. Or do we let him go? They decided to let him go. They were slaughtered. So if you go out toward Gush Etzion today, you see a little monument to the Lamed He, and there are songs about them, and they became very famous in the early Zionist, the pre-state Zionist lore, the Lamed He. That was on January 15th, in 1948. They fought, by the way, to the last bullet, which is exactly what you'd expect. They weren't going to surrender because there was no use surrendering. May 12th, 2 days before, or 3 days before the end of the mandate, the Arab Legion attacked. Right, the Arab Legion is the British-trained Jordanian army. They're trained by, commanded by a guy named Glubb, G-L-U-B-B, who is from the British Army originally. Many in his high command are from the British Army. This is, at that time, the best armed and trained Arab force. So the Arab Legion has basically said, we're going to take the West Bank and Jerusalem. The first kibbutz was captured the next day. Four of 131 people survived after surrendering. They were massacred. 2 days later, a similar fate happened for the three other kibbutzim, but there were more survivors, and some of the survivors were taken to Jordan, and they lived and were given back to the Israelis after the war. Total of 240 people were killed. Postscript, on March 49, 320 people were released from a Jordanian POW camp. So from the Jordanians, they could do that. But these two things, Gush Etzion, and this is the Lamed He, the 35, being brought to burial, are some of the legends or great stories of that time. And here's the Arab Legion posed with two of the four Jewish survivors of the fall of Gush Etzion. Any questions until now?
I would just say it's a little bit of a testament to the Arab Legion that they actually took prisoners and exchanged them, whereas
yeah, they're
many
British
other
trained.
Instances,
yeah.
They would not have, and there would be no survivors.
Yeah, there are stories. I was just reading a book about the 67 War, and one of the Arabs captured said to one of the Jewish commanders, what are you going to do to us? And the Jewish commander said, we're not going to do anything to you that you wouldn't do to us. And the guy said, please don't do that. So, yeah. I mean, this is the harsh realities of the Middle East. And, you know, I say that as a guy who's spent a lot of time in, you know, Jewish-Arab dialogues, which I still believe in very strongly. All right. One of the biggest struggles was to gain weapons. Where do you gain weapons? Well, a lot of interesting things are going on in the world right now in the mid to late 1940s. The world has just had a major war. There's a lot of surplus stuff. You think of it, I don't know the number, how many, a couple million U.S. men served in the military? Right?
14 million.
14 million? I mean, I don't, and combine the world, I mean, literally there could have been 100 million people in arms. You have a lot of extra guns. You have a lot of extra tanks, you got a lot of extra personnel carriers, and so on, and so on, and so on. Ben-Gurion knows this, but it's not so easy to bring stuff into Palestine with the British there. And it's not so easy to find the money for it. So what do? They set up front companies around the world, certainly including the United States. You know, the United States, as but one example at that time, is having a lot of auctions for military vehicles. And the money, you know, you could buy an armored personnel carrier or something like that and plant flowers in it or something like that. There was something called the U.S. War Assets Administration, and they were set up to sell surplus American weapons.
I thought it was Sunny Surplus.
Sunny Surplus, yeah. On Liberty Road. Yeah, right. Is that still there?
No.
Not too bad.
And Sengola.
Yeah. They used to sell tear gas. So, helping pay for this. Well, let me talk about this guy first. One of the things that they did is they went to this sympathetic American economist, Robert Nathan, and Hoover had heard that the Jews were going around buying weapons. So Nathan was sent to pacify Hoover, and this is the conversation he records. You know, Hoover says, this is not straight up and above board. Some prominent people and some important organizations could be heard. And Hoover wanted to know whether any of the weapons were to be used in the United States. No. Were any of them to be used against the United States? Absolutely not. Hoover made no promise, but the indication was that he would cooperate. He was sympathetic. So if you know anything about Hoover, Hoover basically said, meets my agenda, you go ahead and do it, unless you create problems for me. I'm not going to create problems for you, but by the way, if you create problems for me, you're screwed.
Yeah, this is not really represent. I mean, this is misleading because...
In what regard?
Well, there was an arms embargo, official U.S. policy, it was no weapons.
Yes.
Right? And this just, what happened was there was, not aggressive prosecution, but there were extensive efforts to prevent any flow of arms.
Right.
It was illegal to, just like it is today with ISIS, to go in and fight, to go for any U.S. citizen to go and join the Haganah, and that people had to be smuggled out. In fact, many of the pilots over there were American, some war
right, it's a group called Machal. Right.
Smuggled out of the country. And it was really, and plus the British interfered, because they're, Attlee and Bevin's very anti-Semitic, right?
Right.
So you had the Czechs that really provided most
of the survival. Right.
Right.
But Hoover found out this was going on under his nose. So Hoover basically said, I need to meet with a representative from you guys. I'm not going to worry about it. Yes, there was an arms embargo from the British and the United States, too. And the United States kept that arms embargo open until the early 50s, roughly. Until the early 50s. But yes, you're absolutely correct. But the Czechs, particularly in 47, it shifted by 49. In 47, the Soviets, for some reason, allowed, and we're really not quite sure why, allowed the Czechs to sell weapons to the Israelis. When I say weapons, I mean airplanes. I mean lots of stuff.
I don't think the Soviets had really consolidated control by that time. It was a sort of a loosely democratic government. So the exiled government came back and
right.
was kind of
right. that I
had
know.
Some control until.
Right.
Consolidated power
but,
like 40, 50.
But I've always wondered, I mean, I've looked at some of that material, if the Soviets, because remember, the Soviets also approved the partition vote, mm-hmm. right? So if the Soviets didn't want it to happen, I just think they could have made it not happen. You know, the government was in flux then, but they had more power there than, for example, the British or the United States.
Well, they wanted to embarrass the British. Another way to embarrass the British.
Right. Well, they also, some of them actually also thought that that since there was a socialist government that ultimately it might wind up being communist. Remember, there was an Israeli communist party as well called Maki. They didn't have much power, but they spoke some of the same languages. Ben-Gurion clearly saw interest being aligned with the West and clearly with the United States. And he, remember, Ben-Gurion, if anything, is a great politician. Within 7 years, he goes to war with the British against the Egyptians. So I hear what you're saying. I'm going to look up a little more on that. You want to say something? I thought someone else here said something.
I think the arms embargo in the United States up by February of 48, they think Israel has a very good chance of losing.
And not only that, but they're considering asking the United Nations to extend the mandate at that point as well. And, of course... the Secretary of State, Marshall, says to the President at that time, you know, if you agree or recognize the state of Israel, and this was an election coming up, I wouldn't vote for you. Clark Clifford has a great chapter on that in his biography, and Chapter 3 is all about that. And that's a great place to look for that information. Absolutely. But Truman stuck with his guns because... of a relationship he seemed a respect he seemed to have for Chaim Weizmann, who was sent to the United States specifically with the purpose of swaying Truman, although some would argue that Ben-Gurion sent him to the United States so that he would be out of the country when it was declared, so that he couldn't sign the Declaration of Independence, because Chaim Weizmann did not sign the Declaration of Independence. And he was really the guy that held the Jewish Agency as well as the World Zionist Organization together for a couple decades. Remember, Ben-Gurion had pushed him out in 35, but he was still a power. All right, so go. Let me just skip ahead to make sure that we have time for something else. So let me talk a little bit about, this is a guy named Rudolf Sonneborn. I don't know if any of you guys have ever heard of him. Anyone ever heard of him? So Rudolf Sonneborn was a wealthy industrialist who lived in New York City, and he was very sympathetic to the Zionist cause. And Ben-Gurion basically had people go to him and say, we need help. We need weapons, and we need money for weapons. So Sonneborn created something called the Sonneborn Institute. And he had people come to his living room, and he would sit there, and he and others would talk to them, and they would pledge money. It was the old-fashioned way. And that's how they raised a substantial amount of money for Free State Israel, as well as Israel. And this is obviously just a trip to Israel after the founding of the state. But he and Ben-Gurion had a nice relationship. He's got a neat biography that goes into some of this stuff, too. So, I mean, there's so much to read. You know, there's only so little time. All right. Let me move ahead to... Oh, this is another thing. And I know, Mitch, you've been here. This is the Ayalon Institute. Mm-hmm. Why don't you spend a minute or two telling us about it?
The one they hold...
Would you move the washing machines and you go downstairs?
Underneath,
this is the washing machine.
Underneath to hide it from the British. It actually is the beginning of the Israel military industrial complex.
Absolutely. So there's a kibbutz in the center of the country, and they had these huge washing machines, and they did the laundry for the kibbutzim in the area. So if, however, you move the machine, there was a trapdoor. And you went downstairs, and it's really neat. I've been down there. And you have a bullet manufacturing place, and you have a weapons range where you test weapons that you made in the bullets. And what they would do is when the British were coming, they would just move the washing machines back over. And as the story they told me when I was there goes, the British, and they would say to the British, by the way, because the British would do periodic inspections, surprise inspections, because they knew the Haganah was around somewhere. You know, you can't hide 2,000 people that easily, or 2,800 people, whatever it was. And they'd say, would you like some beer? And they said, sure. So the British said one day, you always give us a warm beer. Can't you have cold beer for us? And they said, well, if you would call us and tell us you're coming, we'll put the beer on ice for about an hour. And then it'll be cold for you. They said, okay. You know? So, you know, Jewish ingenuity, what can I tell you? So that brings us to two people I want to mention, the two Yigals of modern Jewish history. One is Yigal Yadin. Isn't that a nice picture of Edward G. Robinson? Haven't seen him for quite some time. He was a supporter of the State of Israel. He was a really neat guy. Does anybody know, well actually, is anybody familiar with his archaeological work on Masada? So I forgot to bring it. I have a book at home that came out in the 60s. Yeah, about Masada. It's like digging at Masada. It's got a picture of him on the cover. He was the guy. His dad was an archaeologist. He was a prototype, you know, modern Israeli hero. Secular military hero who totally knew Jewish history inside and out. Excavated Masada. He's the guy that started the whole thing. Right? And that was really his passion in life. He joined the Haganah at age 15, right? Very young. So he got in an argument with his commander. He left for a while. He would get in an argument with Ben-Gurion. He would leave the Haganah at that point. He would go in and out of various government jobs. He resigned as chief of staff to military cuts. There are cuts to the military budget. So he was a very principled individual. In 67, he was the military advisor to Levi Eshkol. And we are going to spend a lot of time talking about Levi Eshkol, because he's really kind of an unknown guy in Jewish history, in modern history. He served on the Agronot Commission in 73, which was the commission that looked into Israel's behavior leading up to the Yom Kippur War. But he's most famous for his Dead Sea Scroll excavations. He did a doctoral thesis on the translation of the Dead Sea Scrolls. He spoke out against Israeli politicos stealing artifacts, Do you know who he was talking about?
Moshe Dayan.
Moshe Dayan. If you walked into Moshe Dayan's house, he would usher you into the backyard, and you would have the finest collection of ancient steles and figurines and statues and whatever. Moshe Dayan was an out-and-out thief. He was. He was above it all. He would go. He too was an amateur archaeologist, and he would go around on his spare time digging. And in fact, at one point, he was digging in a cave and it collapsed on him. He almost died. He struggled and got out of there. He was in the hospital for a few weeks after that. He had a collapsed lung from that.
Back in the day, you could just walk around outside and find artifacts.
Just
walking coins and little pictures and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a treasure trove, and it still is. It still is. And of course, as you know, Israel is the only country in the world where if you're putting up a building and you come to an archaeological ruin, you have to stop until the Antiquities Authority comes and documents what it is and says, oh, we already have 52 of those structures on Earth, so now you can put up your Supersol or whatever you want to put up there. All right, he later became famous after being fed up with the political direction of the country, particularly after the 73 war. This is supposed to say 1977, obviously. He set up a political party called Dash, which is the Democratic Movement for Change. Came out of nowhere, won 15 seats. This periodically happens in Israeli elections. Came into the coalition, was named deputy prime minister, wasn't in love with Begin in large regards, left the government in 81. Or he didn't serve a second term, I should say, which Begin won in 81. But he was a substantial individual. And he's, like I said, he's kind of the prototype for the modern Israelis. And the next Yigal that we come to, anybody know who that is? You got it. I keep saying Yigal. It's really Yigael. Yigal is kind of the English ones. Here's my favorite picture. One of my favorite pictures. Moshe Dayan, Yitzchak Sadeh, the first commander of the Haganah, Yigal Alon, at Kibbutz Chanita, where I lived in the 1985 for a good chunk of the year. We used to walk around on Shabbat and say, oh, look, Moshe Dayan's eye, because it's right on the Lebanese border. Watch where you step. It's a beautiful area. Hey, we passed the time, what can I tell you? All right, so you got it on. So there you have his years. He served in Nord Wingate's special night squads. He was a founding member of the Palmach, and he was in the Knesset for 25 years in the Labor Party, and he was one of the guys who fought with Ben-Gurion. There was always fighting with Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion always won, but there was always people fighting with Ben-Gurion. What else do I want to tell you about him before going on to the Olon plan? All right, after he retired from active duty in 1950, he went into politics. And it was after the 67 war that he came up with what is today known as, and still debated, the Olon plan. So you may or may not have heard of this, but this is one of, particularly right after 67 war, one of the more creative approaches. He was one of the few who said we can't rule all the Arabs. So he came up with a plan that said Israel retained a third of the West Bank, including settlements and military installations, the Jericho-Jerusalem road. It will develop the neighborhoods of East Jerusalem, ostensibly meaning that it's going to take over a good chunk of East Jerusalem, annex Gaza, which, now, anybody think of why anyone in the world would want to annex Gaza, particularly in 67? Any thoughts on that?
Just to keep the Egyptians out.
That's part of it. The Egyptians are still a major army, and they're going to obviously be a major threat in six more years. Any other thoughts on why you'd want to annex Gaza?
The border, I mean, just look at it. It's got such a long border with the rest of the country.
And Gaza is continually the place, this must stun you, of where terrorists come from. So if you control Gaza, you can stop the terrorists, goes the thinking. See how history repeats itself? There are calls today, obviously, to reoccupy Gaza. And as is always the case for Israel, the question is whether or not it's worth the cost. But there's lots of things Israel can do. Yeah?
It's the second part that would have to go along with annexing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, settle the people elsewhere.
Right. Well, and that's what we call transfer. And in the 1980s, Rechavim Ze'evi had a political party, Moledet, which had a few seats in the Knesset, and their whole platform was about transfer. We're going to drive them all to the Jordanian border, and we're going to say, that's the way. See you later. That's a strain in Israeli thought as well. But the interesting thing is, and the blue is Israel, the major Arab population centers are here and here. The interesting thing is, he's the first guy at a time when not many people were willing to say it, who said, we can't rule these people. Now, this is either balkanized or a start, depending on how you want to look at it. Balkanized or a start. And people still come up with that today. What he also said at that time, which may not be as applicable today, is that you need to control the river valley going through here to stop the Jordanians. The first time I went to Israel in 1983, when the Dead Sea wasn't half dried up, as it is now, I remember them saying, you know, you don't want the Jordanians to be able to drive their tanks across here and down here. Right now, today, few would argue that that would be the case. However, King Abdullah could be overthrown, country's 65-75% Palestinian. Who knows? Who knows what tomorrow will bring? As many of the Israeli leaders often say to the United States leaders, you know that in our next election, we'll still be a democracy. Can you say that for others?
Right.
So, it's an interesting debate.
Well, one more point about that map, especially when the line that divides the blue and the green, especially on the north, is that that's the top of a mountain ridge.
So right, right. That's right.
If the Israelis control the top, then they can look down on the Jordan and have strategic advantage.
And he wanted to set up kibbutzim along there. And when you guys get to that book, by, it's not Hillel Halkin, what's the third book that we have? Gershom Gorenberg. By Gershom Gorenberg, Yigal Alon is in there a lot talking about putting settlements on the hilltops. And that, by the way, is where many, not all, but many Israeli settlements on the West Bank today are on hilltops because they surround command surrounding areas, particularly roads coming in and out. So, all right. Unfortunately, one of the things is, a quick word. Meanwhile, the British are trying to maintain order. This is what part of Israel looked like. This was in Jerusalem. This is what's going on in the country at the time. That's crazy. This is the Malka area, if any of you know it, outside the walls of the old city. It's really amazing. Their goal was to separate the Arabs and the Jews. They weren't interested in commingling. They weren't interested in people getting along. It wasn't worth it to them. And here, of course, British Marines leaving Jerusalem for Haifa. And at home, we don't have time, but there's a lot of videos on the website, on websites that you could look at. Whoops. Unfortunately, this created real tragedy and human suffering, as war always does. You know, no matter what your perspective is, you have to have emotion. This was the scene for many Palestinians. Now, I'll be very candid. Some Palestinians left because their leaders told them to leave and then come back. Others fled because they were told, because they knew war was coming. And some were picked out by the Israelis. It's a mix. And Benny Morris has done a lot of work on this. So there's no one school of thought. Particularly in areas like Lida and Ramla, they were told to leave. And somebody asked Ben-Gurion, apparently, at one point, what should we do with them? And he went like this. And he walked away. By doing that, he never gave the order. He was a very smart man. But they understood what he meant. They took what they could take. We know that upwards to 750,000 Palestinian Arabs left. That's a lot of people, versus 750,000 Palestinian Arabs left. And here's where they went. The bulk of them went to the West Bank. And then the next bulk went to the Gaza Strip. you know, and then they met the Israelis again in 1967, you know, less than 20 years later. But, you know, one thing I'm still not clear on, a lot more, I think, after 67 went to Jordan, because that's only 70,000 there. And the country now, like I said, is about 70% Palestinian. So that's where they all went. And meanwhile, Jews are pouring into Israel, right? As soon as independence is declared. Just a brief mention, ties with King Abdullah I. The Zionist movement, since 1920, had had a relationship with him. And he said to them, you know, when war looked more and more clear, look, I just want the West Bank and Jerusalem. I'm going to leave you guys alone. I'm not going to attack you. And he was pretty much good to his word. But that meant there were battles in Jerusalem. That meant there were battles in Latrun. That meant there were skirmishes elsewhere. So 4 days before independence, he tells Golda Meir, why are you in such a hurry to proclaim your state? Why don't you wait a few years? I will take over the whole country and you will be represented in my parliament. I will treat you very well and there will be no war. Now Meir said, we've been waiting 2,000 years. So, but his successors, King Hussein, and now his great-grandson, King Abdullah II, continued to have good relationships with the Israelis. And it's been very beneficial.
He
was assassinated in 1951 at the Al-Aqsa Mosque by a Palestinian nationalist who was upset about his ties with the Israelis.
Yeah, because he was too moderate.
Yeah, he was coming down the steps after prayer on a Friday morning, and he was assassinated. And King Hussein was there and saw it. And that made him reluctant to be public about his ties with the Israelis for many years. And in fact, King Hussein wouldn't make peace with the Israelis until the Palestinians had the Oslo Accords. The Oslo Accords are September 15, 1993. Hussein doesn't make peace until October 94. He was not going to be first. Finally, so there's a thing of the last British troops. The results of the Palestine Civil War. This is leading us up to May 14th, 15th. Many more, these 5.5 months resulted in decisive Jewish victory. I need a quote there. The Palestinian Arab military was crushed. Palestinians were crushed. Other Arab armies would come in, but they wouldn't find a Palestinian infrastructure to help them. Hundreds of thousands of fleeing Arabs were fleeing combat zones, bad writing. Palestinians from unaffected areas did not join the fighting. Ben-Gurion and others promised them, if you don't fight, we won't harm you. And that's indeed the case, what happened, particularly in places like Haifa, where the mayor of the city went around knocking on Arab doors, asking them to stay. Haganah transformed into an army and consolidated territory. We didn't talk about it, but there was something called Operation Dalit in early 1948, where they solidified control over the Galilee. Great Britain's prestige diminished as it could not stop the violence. We talked about that. The Yishuv solidified despite its differences. Remember the animosity between Irgun and Haganah? Important ties with Abdullah. Ben-Gurion is the undisputed leader of the Yishuv. Note, and this is my note, the tide could have easily turned with the right leadership for Arabs. The Jews were more focused in purpose and motivation. If the Arabs had the motivation that the Jews had, it could have been a very different story. The Jews didn't have a choice. The only Arabs that really had a choice, well, I shouldn't say that. The Arab armies that invaded could go home. The Palestinians fled because it was war. Jews couldn't go anywhere. And the Jews had an esprit de corps, and the Jews had a historical narrative on their side, a united vision of the past that was driving their future. The Arab world then and now is disparate in terms of goals and desires very often. And there's very often petty fighting amongst the leadership. We've seen that in a lot of conflicts, unfortunately. So tonight, what we've done...
Why do you say unfortunately?
Because a lot of people have been killed. That's why, and that's bad anyway you cut it. You know, I believe that if people want to, they can sit down and work out their differences. I'm naive like that, but that's the way I am. So, and when I say unfortunately, for example, it's not Arab, but Iran and Iraq, their war in 1980 to 1988. Neither Persian, I know the Iranians, but that was totally unnecessary war. You know, you've Chad and Libya had wars in the 90s. Totally unnecessary. You know, it's just crazy leaders. It's just getting people killed. It's just, anyway. We've gone all the way up to 1948. Tonight we've gone from Tel Aviv and Ben Gurion to the Haganah and the Palmach, and some very sad chapters, whether it's Deir Yassin or Gush Etzion, and the British leaving, and Holocaust survivors coming in, and that's where we're going to pick up next week. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good job.
Thank you, sir.